Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We spend this hour with North Carolina Superior Court Judge Lou Trosh. After 27 years on the bench, first on the district court, Judge Trosh has decided not to run for re-election and will exchange his judge's robe for an attorney's suit and tie. So we thought we'd look back on his long career and accomplishments, including becoming the first judge in the state certified as a child welfare law specialist by the National Association of Counsel for Children, and the time he spent focusing on juvenile and family courts. Judge Trosh also co-chaired the Race Matters for Juvenile Justice initiative and served as Charlotte's model court lead judge, all while presiding over several significant non-family court-related trials, including the recent case involving the men accused and now convicted of killing Charlotte sandwich shop owner Scott Brooks. We'll reflect on that and other notable trials, changes in the judicial system, and more. Judge Lou Trosh, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I think you were here in 2016.
Wow.
That's a long time ago.
Almost a decade, right?
What kept you away? Was it the question?
You didn't ask me back, Mike. I think I drove you crazy.
So 27 years on the bench, it's a long time to do any job.
Yeah.
Believe me, I know. And your time on the bench is approaching that milestone, but you're not retiring. You're transitioning. You're going to keep your legal mind in shape and become an attorney again. What do you anticipate that transition is going to be like?
Wow, I've been thinking a lot about it. So first of all, let me say, so people have asked me, so you're retiring, is it the December 31st? So I will say, first of all, I'm not running this time. So my time ends December of 2026 on the bench. And then I'm going to join my family's law firm, Conrad Trosh & Kimmy. It's been a while since I have practiced law, but when you're sitting on the bench and you're watching lawyers, you're thinking to yourself, you know, I'd ask this question. You know, I'd ask that question. Why don't they do this? And so I'm going to get the chance to see whether my grand ideas on the bench actually work in practice.
I hate to tell you this, but I do that when I watch television, news programs. I would ask this. I would ask that. And I'm still doing it. So it's going to still frustrate you. When you announced that you were not going to run again, you quoted Ecclesiastes, and you did it again just before we started this conversation on the air, to everything there is a season. What makes this the right time, the right season?
So I've been on the bench for 27, it'll be 28 years. I've done a lot of things. I've worked with an incredible group of people. And at some point, you know, it's time to move on. I was in district court for up until 2018, doing great things. I loved it. I feel like I'm called to do my job. But other people need to take over. You know, other people need to take the mantle and move forward. I'm standing on the shoulders of others before me, and others will take my place. The world's going to keep going. The courts will keep trying cases, whether I'm there or not. And I'm excited to... My son moved back down to Charlotte. He's 32, and my brother's practiced law. My dad's actually almost in his 60th year of practicing law, and so I'm going to join them again, and really looking forward to going back to the family law firm.
But now you'll be on the other side of the bench, and you'll be saying, if I were the judge, I would have done this or that or the other thing. How will that be?
I don't know. My former colleagues are probably going to enjoy telling me to sit down and threatening to hold me in contempt of court if I don't be quiet. But we'll see how it goes. It's going to be interesting. I had a friend that retired, and she said, "I said, what do you miss about the bench?" And she said, "I thought it was going to be, well, I miss you guys. I miss the cases. I miss the trials." And she says, "You want me to be honest?" And I said, "Yeah, be honest." And she said, "The phone." I said, "What do you mean the phone?" And she said, when I call as a judge, people answer the phone. And now that I'm not a judge anymore, sometimes I get the voicemail. So I'm expecting to get a lot of voicemails in 12 months or so.
People may not know this. I didn't know it. You are Mecklenburg County's longest serving judge.
Yes.
Is that a record, or is that just right now among all the judges? You're the longest.
I think among all the judges now. My good friend Judge Ricky McCoy Mitchell, who retired a couple years ago, I think she was on the bench about the same amount of time or longer than me. And I'm sure there have been judges in the past. Yeah. I haven't really done a calculation, but for right now, she used to always say I'm the longest serving judge, and I was second longest. So I would stand up and say, "Well, I'm the tallest judge." Now I get to say for a short time that I'm the longest serving judge.
You began in 1999, which doesn't seem like all that long ago to me, but you began in 1999 as a judge on the 26th Judicial District, and 19 years later, in 2018, if I've done the math right, you became a Superior Court judge. And for many, including myself, the court system is a complete mystery. We don't understand how it works. I don't care how many legal shows you watch on television, we don't get it. So explain the differences between those two courts, the district court, the superior court, both of which you've worked on.
Sure. North Carolina has what's called a bifurcated trial court system. So district court handles certain types of cases. So they handle all the family court matters, all the juvenile court matters, misdemeanor criminal offenses. They handle the felony cases at the very beginning of the proceedings, and then they handle smaller civil court matters. Superior Court handles felony trials, so more serious criminal cases, and then larger civil cases, and that's basically how it breaks down. I could go into a lot more details and show you some graphs, but I think that pretty much sums it up.
You became a judge, the first judge in the state to be certified by the National Association of Counsel for Children as a child welfare law specialist. Before we talk about the significance of that, talk about how that came to be. Did you have a personal interest in juvenile court cases? I mean, I know that, as you just mentioned, district court handles those cases. Is that where that interest developed? Talk about that.
Yeah. I came to Charlotte as an attorney at something called the Children's Law Center, which later merged with the Council for Children's Rights. Unfortunately, we've lost that organization. It leaves a huge hole in our juvenile and family courts. But I was a lawyer representing kids in a variety of court proceedings. And I saw judges, I felt like being able to make even more of a difference than I could. So there were some giants on the bench, Judge Yvonne Mims-Evans, Judge Bill Jones, who I just watched do extraordinary things, both in individual cases, but also off the bench. They used judicial leadership. Judges, whether you got a good personality or not, when you're wearing a robe, you have positional leadership. And they use that leadership outside the courtroom to not only change what happened in one case, but the entire system. So they call people.
Give me an example of that.
Sure. We created something called the model court system. It used to be when I came to court, everybody worked in silos. So the Department of Social Services did their thing. They might change the way that they assign their attorneys or schedule their cases, and they wouldn't let us know until we walked into court one day. The court operated in their little silo, did their own thing, and we might change the way judges were handling cases or the way we scheduled cases, and we wouldn't tell anybody until the last minute. So Judge Jones and Judge Evans and Judge Harper, some other judges, worked with a national organization called the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges and made Charlotte what's called a model court. Not a perfect court, but a court that's willing to use collaboration and judicial leadership to change the whole system. So we created a model court committee where we called all the stakeholders, the school system, the police department, the Department of Social Services, the guardian ad litem, all the people that work with kids and families together in a meeting, and started to build small victories. And over time, we completely transformed how the court system worked.
Why did that happen here? What was it about Charlotte?
We had the right leadership at the right time in a community that wanted, I think we had the right leadership before me, and then during my time, both on the bench but also off the bench. So in all those organizations, people are willing to come together, and instead of pointing fingers at one another, to hold hands and say, look, all of us bear responsibility for what's going on. with our kids and families. So let's work together to solve that. That's how Race Matters for Juvenile Justice came into being, for example.
Which I want to talk about. But you've made that transition from the district mm-hmm. judge where you dealt with a lot of these cases to the Superior Court, where I'm sure the number of those cases are few and far between.
Yes.
Was that a difficult transition given your investment in this?
It was incredibly hard. It really was. It was an opportunity to both hear different kinds of cases, which I think in everybody's life you need to evolve and reach for new challenges. But I had defined myself as a juvenile court judge. That was what I was called to do. But I also felt like if you stay too long, things become just about you rather than about the larger collective, if that makes sense. And we had really good and have really good juvenile judges that followed me, and things continued to move forward. And people had new ideas. You have so many ideas and then you get stale. And it was time for me to take my ideas to a place where those ideas had not been tried yet, and for other people to bring their ideas to juvenile court so they could flower and blossom. And I think that's what's happened.
So you were the first judge in the state to be certified as a child welfare law specialist. What does that mean? How did it affect people who found themselves in the juvenile justice system?
So judges traditionally in juvenile, especially at abuse, neglect, and dependency court, but also delinquency court, were not assigned to cases, didn't fully understand childhood development, how children think, how trauma impacts children. And they just kind of, when that's the case, they didn't take control of their cases. The lawyers sort of drove everything, and the judges didn't take ownership of the cases. We began assigning judges to juvenile court cases so that I hear the same family every time they come to court. And in an abuse and neglect case, families come to court for years while the parents are trying to work to have their children returned to them, or if they can't do that, for us to find another permanent home for that child. Understanding how children think, how experiences impact children, completely transforms how you handle a juvenile court case. Being assigned that case at the same time makes it your case. And so you don't continue a case when some lawyers say, well, you know, we're going to continue it. You think to yourself, no, if I continue this, this child's going to go 3 or 4 months without an answer, without a decision about, are they going to see their mom and dad? Are they not going to see their mom and dad? Are they going to be able to go to summer camp or not go to summer camp? And once I became certified, I better understood, I think, the ways that what we do impacts children.
You've been away from that court for a long time now.
Yes.
Does that continue?
Does what?
That practice.
Yes,
continue.
It does. Yes, as I said, we've got incredible juvenile court judges that continue the same practice. They continue to have a model court committee. They continue to work on innovating and changing things as life's change.
Because when you first came to preside over juvenile court, those cases were described, or those courts were described as punitive and adult focused. And then in 1999, our state was one of only two that automatically prosecuted 16 and 17 year olds as adults, regardless of the offense. You became a leading voice for reform in that area. Why?
Well, we all now know that, I think everybody knows that the psychologists say that your mind doesn't fully develop till you're 25. So a 16-year-old's not thinking like a 19-year-old or a 22-year-old. And North Carolina was one of two states. Believe it or not, it's the one thing that New York and North Carolina had in common. We were the two states that said if you were 16, the day you turned 16, you automatically went to adult court. And we decided to change that.
I have about 15 seconds. Was
sure.
it difficult to move the needle?
Yes, it was. But we succeeded.
Okay. Judge Lou Trosh is with us, Superior Court judge who is hanging it up in December of next year and not running for re-election. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Judge Lou Trosh is with us. He's North Carolina's, or the Charlotte, he's Mecklenburg County's longest-serving judge who has decided not to run for re-election in the November election this fall. So he will no longer be a Superior Court judge in December of next year. But we thought we'd have the exit interview now and talk about his vast experience and history. We're talking about when you first came to preside over juvenile court, and you're no longer presiding over that court, but it was punitive and adults-focused, and you moved to change that. And I asked you how difficult a process that was, and you said it was very difficult, but it's become one centered on rehabilitation and one that's more youth-oriented. How did you come to understand what needed to be done?
That's a long process, Mike. Through years and years of working with kids, of things like being certified, of working and starting to understand the experts, right? The social workers, the case managers, the mental health workers, and listening to them over the years, I understood that there was a lot about kids that I didn't understand. And I think when people grow up, they think everybody grows up just like they did and thinks just the way they thought. And I came to realize that way of thinking leads to assumptions and leads to misunderstandings about where kids are coming from because of maybe the way they talk or the way they dress. You make assumptions about them, and those assumptions often get you into trouble.
There's also apparently an intersection of race in all of this, too. And for 10 years, you served as the co-chair of the Race Matters for Juvenile Justice Initiative. We know. Well, you were on this program in 2016 to talk about that topic. And at the time, we knew that African Americans made up 35% of the city's population and yet represented 70% of the arrests. And minority children were suspended from school more often than white children. I don't know if that continues, but the school system was certainly aware of it because we've talked about that on this program. Has it changed?
No, the disparate impact, disproportionality of kids of color in foster care, in detention, in suspended from school, in situations of unemployment continues to this day. We have done a lot to try and move the dial, but it's really hard. It's a big effort to move the dial. I became aware of it. I can tell you a story about how I got involved with it. So I had these two kids, and they robbed a McDonald's. They watched, you remember the movie Ocean's 11?
Mm-hmm.
So they watched the movie Ocean's 11. They get the bright idea. Let's go rob somebody, right? Like they did on the show, but we don't have casinos in Charlotte, so we do have a lot of McDonald's. So they go to the McDonald's. They're terrible at it. They've never been in trouble before, and they're charged with armed robbery. So they come to my courtroom. I've got a lot of cases, and this is where I realize that I'm making assumptions and thinking about things in maybe the wrong way because the two kids come to court. I hear that what's called a first appearance where you tell them what they're charged with, decide whether they're going to stay in detention. They're generally in detention with a serious offense like that. You talk to their families and then set another court date and make sure they've met with their lawyers. And so in doing that, one of the things you have to decide is should they stay in detention or not. Again, they're normally in detention. So the first kid comes in. He's in detention. He comes in with the bailiff. His family comes in. I oftentimes only get one parent. But in this child, I get mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, cousins, uncles, and a stack of letters about this kid's never been in trouble. This is a terrible mistake. He didn't do this. You should let him out. And I said, look, it's a really serious charge. We're going to look at something called alternatives to detention. We'll come back today's Monday. We'll come back Thursday. If all these things check out that you're saying, we'll let them out. So in that hearing, second young man comes in, but he's not in detention. I asked the bailiff. He's sitting by the detention door. Where is the second co-defendant? He's not. Nobody else is back here. And I said, well, where is he? And then I notice he's in the audience with his family. And he comes up and he sits down and I go through the recommendations from my court counselor, my district attorney, the defense attorney, the case manager. And they recommend that he stay out of detention, that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. He follows some sort of standard conditions, stay out of trouble, don't go to the McDonald's anymore, stay away from the co-defendant, go to school every day, and that we'll schedule another court hearing. And I start asking questions like, well, wait a minute, what's going on with this kid that he's not in detention, he's not being held in a locked facility, and the other kid was held in a locked facility? And of course, most of your listeners will be able to guess that one kid was white and one kid was black, and which kid was in detention and which kid was not in detention. And so I start asking all of these questions. Did one of them have a gun? Was it the idea of one of them? No, they came up with this together. They watched this movie. They both had these. They turned out to be toy guns, like water pistols. They both come from two-parent families. They both live in the same neighborhood. I couldn't find any differences other than their race. So I did what Americans typically do. I think what people do, I look for the bad person. So I started looking, was it the person that recommended detention? Maybe it was another judge that put him in detention. Maybe it was the police. Maybe it was this person. I'm looking for the person who's Archie Bunker. You know, I'm dating myself there.
No.
any rate, and that's what I did. And then I thought about it, and I looked around my courtroom. And it's a very diverse group of people. They're men, they're women, they're black representatives, white representatives, old, young. And I work with them every day. We have a team, so that I work with the same team every day. I'm like, I work with these guys every day. I know that they're not trying to treat these two children differently, and yet they did. What's going on? And then I thought, this next thought I thought was, whoa, wait a minute. How many times have I done something like this because I've made assumptions about people? What's going on? And that led me to a journey, and some other people in Charlotte, to a journey to look at what are we doing that leads to people being treated differently because of things like race or economics or what neighborhood you're from. And that led to Race Matters for Juvenile Justice. And my co-chair, Elisa Chingeri, who's our clerk now, and I started a journey that we didn't plan on starting with a number of other committed individuals to try to change that.
I mean, sometimes racism is overt. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it is purposeful. Sometimes it is not. Sometimes the people who are perpetrating racial ideas or racial attitudes and actions are completely unaware. They would not recognize it in themselves. So how do you purge the legal system of that?
That's a big question, Mike. What we did is we created a bench card. And the bench card it's a checklist. So there's a reason that doctors, for example, do a checklist when they do a surgery, or when you see them getting ready to take off on a plane, they follow a checklist. It's to make sure that you get all the information, and that you then, for me, when I get all the information, then I can decide the case based on the information, the facts, as opposed to assumptions. If you don't have a checklist, for example, then you forget some things, right? You assume past some things. You're like, oh, we always do that, right? We always take the scalpel out of the person when we don't leave scissors inside people. But if you don't have the checklist, sometimes, especially in the crunch of time or when you're under pressure, you forget those things. So we created a system of questions that we ask in the hearing to make sure we're getting all the information. We also created and this is with the help of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, a little question set that judges ask of themselves beforehand to make sure you're thinking through things and not making assumptions. Am I deciding this based on the facts? Have I asked all the questions that I need to ask? Am I basing this on anything other than the evidence that I've heard or the law in North Carolina? And that helps me set my mind in a way to try and avoid those things. But it's not easy.
Do you remember what the outcome of that McDonald's case was?
Everybody asks. I always forget. So the white guy, I put in detention, just like the other young man was in detention, and said, look, this is an armed robbery. It's really serious. I hear what your family's saying and everything that you're saying, but we need to make sure we check all this out. And both of them got out on the Thursday. They had never been in trouble before. They ended up admitting responsibility to a less serious crime because it ended up being a less serious crime. And as far as I know, I never saw them again, and they've never been in trouble again.
You transitioned from a district court judge to the Superior Court in 2018. And the previous year, the General Assembly passed that Raise the Age Law, which raised juvenile jurisdiction to 18 for nonviolent crimes. And a year after you ascended to the Superior Court, 16 and 17-year-olds charged with misdemeanors were handled in juvenile and not adult court. What role did you play in either of those laws being passed?
So we had a whole effort called Raise the Age that I was one of many, many people that talked to legislators that went around the state, both before when we were trying to get a legislation put together. So I worked on committees where we were making recommendations to the legislature and the governor about what should happen. And then once that system was passed by the legislature and signed into law by the governor, was part of a group of people to figure out how to implement that new set of laws in our court system.
So we're about 18, 19 years into that. How would you assess what has happened? Has it made the system fairer to young people, better for society at large? Has it become more of a burden on the system? Because it's a lot of extra work, it seems to me.
I don't think it's a lot of extra work because you're doing it one place or the other,
okay,
right? We used to just send them to adult court. Now they're in juvenile court. So we were going to address the needs of those kids. It's just a different focus that you have when they're in juvenile court as opposed to the adult system, which is punitive based, right? It's about punishing and holding people accountable, whereas the juvenile system's more about, okay, you've made some serious mistakes. What do we need to do in order to get you back on the right path? And I think the system is flexible enough. I think it could be tweaked. I could talk to you. We could have a whole show about what works and what doesn't work. But in general, I think those kids that are committing really serious offenses are still handled in adult court.
Well, there's a recent change in how serious felonies committed by 16 and 17-year-olds are handled. Beginning last year, those cases now start in adult court, and I think judges have the power to make the decision about whether it should stay in that court or be sent to a juvenile court.
Yeah, it's complicated with district attorneys and judges, yes. It used to be the other way around, where judges had a hearing in juvenile court to decide to remove certain kids to adult court, and now it's sort of the reverse.
What's your take on that?
I think that I like the old system where you had a very set list of criteria that judges looked at: the age of the child, the maturity level of the child, their therapeutic history, what they did, the severity of what they did, how they harmed the community, et cetera. So all these factors you would consider and make a decision after hearing from everyone whether they should go to adult or juvenile. I like the presumption to be that they stayed in juvenile and then went to adult, as opposed to they're an adult and then the presumption be they stay in adult unless they go back. That makes sense.
Judge Lou Trosh is our guest. Spent a long time on the juvenile court, but then about 19 years ago moved to Superior Court, if I've done the math, and you just finished presiding over the trial of two men accused of shooting and killing Scott Brooks, the co-owner with his twin brother David of Brooks Sandwich Shop in Noda. This was a high-profile local case, a lot of local interest, and one in which you threatened to clear the courtroom at one point in the gallery for the duration of the trial, which made me wonder why trials that have such public interest, whether they be local trials or national trials, why they aren't on television. Why aren't they? Because I can come and see the trial. I can sit in the courtroom. It's open to the public. When there's so many people interested, invested in this, why isn't it on TV?
Well, we had video, so WSOC was there.
But I mean live. Watch the proceedings.
Well, some trials are. In North Carolina, we've got, I don't know, I follow the policies that we have. I think there's a good argument that the only problem with them being live is there are very set rules. So one of the rules, for example, is you can't show the jury. You can't. And so the only concern is, you do a live show, Charlotte Squawks, every year. Once it happens, stuff goes wrong. And so if you're live, you can't correct for that. So I think that may be the reason that you wouldn't do it. Otherwise, I don't have any problem with it. I didn't have a problem opening the courtroom. The reason that I threatened to close the courtroom in that case was because some of the actions of some of the people in the courtroom.
To the people on the other side of the bench, every trial is important because mm-hmm. people's freedom and their future are at stake. But this is a high-profile trial that a lot of people were vested in because a lot of people knew the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of pressure does that put on you as the judge in the case to make sure that everything is right to the letter and fair?
I'd like to believe that in every case, you know, I'm making sure everything's right to the letter. But I will tell you, when you've got 50, 60 people in court every day, you've got the cameras rolling, you have very complex issues, because it was a very complex trial in addition, because it was two men that were tried at the same time. The defendants were tried together, which doesn't happen very often. It adds just a layer of, you better get this right. Not just to me, but to the district attorneys who did a phenomenal job, to the defense attorneys who also did an excellent job. All of us are trying to make sure, because people don't see what we do all the time, but in those cases, they see what we do and they're watching what we do. And we can't comment. I can't comment on cases generally. So this is an opportunity for the public to get a sense of what's actually happening in a courtroom. So yeah. I want to make sure that we do it right. But it's a lot of pressure.
The defendants in that trial, Stephen Staples and Terry Connor Jr., were found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without possibility of parole. How much latitude do judges have in determining what the ultimate sentence will be?
We have really limited discretion in North Carolina. We have in that case, because of the convictions for first-degree murder, that was the only sentence to give those gentlemen. It didn't matter what their record was. If you're convicted of first-degree murder, that's the sentence. Unless the state's proceeding capitally, they were not, capitally means death penalty, they mm-hmm. were not proceeding in that way. In normal cases, we have a grid. It's like a chart. And there are boxes on the chart, and part of the grid is the record of the defendant, so how many prior criminal offenses have they had or convictions have they had, and the other part of the grid, so the vertical axis of the grid is the level, the seriousness of the offense. The horizontal axis is the record of the defendant, and so you take that and you get to a box. And the box gives me an aggravated range of sentencing, a regular and a mitigated, and there's not a lot of discretion.
Is that particular to North Carolina courts? Because you hear a lot of conversation in politics, in political circles, about activist judges making these wild, outlandish decisions. Is that prescription, that grid system, particular to North Carolina?
It came from the federal system.
Really?
And most states have something similar now, and it's been 20 or more years that we've been using that.
Then I want to come back and talk about activist judges and what's your impression of that when we come back from the break. Judge Lou Trosh is our guest. He's a North Carolina Superior Court judge and is hanging it up, deciding not to run for re-election. We'll come back in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Judge Lou Trosh is with us, the longest-serving judge in Mecklenburg County who has decided not to run for re-election in November and go back into the practice of law. And we'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later on in the program. There's been a lot of conversation in recent years about activist judges, so-called activist judges, particularly when it comes to them doing things that people feel are too lenient and lead to more crime being committed. That certainly came up as a result of the murder on the Blue Line and Irina's Law that the General Assembly debated and passed. That debate centered mostly on pre-trial decisions concerning bail and the fact that police have constantly complained about people being arrested, and by that afternoon they're back out on the streets because of our cashless bail system that is in place in certain situations. And there has been a push toward that in Mecklenburg County, cashless bail, because for some people who are arrested on certain offenses, it can change their life forever. in a way that they cannot recover from, because they lose their job, they lose their house, they lose their families in some cases for offenses that are minor and for which they may be proven ultimately innocent. That's not always the case, though. So what's your view on that?
So I think you've got to look at each person individually. What are they accused of doing? What is their record? What have they done in the past? What is their personal situation? And, you know, the law has given us two main factors that we look at. Is somebody likely to come when we're deciding whether or not they should, what their bond should be? Should they have a secured bond? Should they have an unsecured bond, which means they can sign themselves out? Should they be on pretrial release, or should they not have any bond at all and stay no matter what, how much money they have? And in making that decision, we're supposed to look at, are they likely to come to court, right? Do they appear in court? And are they a danger to the community or not? And my view is that you've got to look at people individually and their individual situations. And that's really hard because we don't have enough resources, we don't have enough time, and we don't have enough information a lot of times.
We're supposed to have a right to a speedy trial.
Yeah.
But if you don't get cashless bail, or if you don't get bail, or if you don't get pretrial release, you could be in jail for a year or two.
That's right. Longer.
Or longer. Is that justice?
Well, I think it's a problem. I think that's why we have to look at that individual person to see what their situation is, and are they in fact a danger to the community? Are there things that we could do to make sure they're out and living their lives while they're waiting, but the community's safe? You remember I Love Lucy? I'm dating myself again, but I Love Lucy. I think it's on TikTok and Instagram.
Everybody
knows I Love Lucy. But there's a scene that they did where they're on the chocolate line.
Yes.
And there's chocolates going by.
Right.
And Lucy and her partner Ethel are trying to wrap the chocolates. And at first they're really slow and they wrap the chocolates and they move on. And then they start coming faster and faster and faster. And they don't have time. So they eat the chocolates. They put them in their hats. It's a big, hilarious sort of slapstick comedy. Well, that's how court is sometimes. If you've got tons and tons and tons of people, you've got 50 people, you have to decide what their bond's going to be that day. You need to have the time to wrap each piece of chocolate, right? Does this person need to stay or go? And we don't always have that time. That's not an excuse, but it's a problem. It's again, a need, I think, for more resources in the court system.
So if the grid system that prescribes what judges can sentence people to is in place in North Carolina and it's based on the federal system, how can there be activist judges?
I think trial court judges especially are just trying to follow the law. I have not met an activist judge, and I can't speak for appellate court judges. I'm not an appellate court judge, and some judges may wander too far into the area that the other branch of government, right, into the legislative branch of government. I can't speak to that. I can speak to trial court judges and to a person, man and woman, that I have worked with. We're just trying to follow the law in a particular case. I have not seen activist judges. I've heard about it now that everything's politicized and in the media, but I've not seen it.
Well, I want to get to that in a second.
Sure.
But the judicial system in Mecklenburg County appears to suffer, and you've said a moment ago, we suffer from a lack of resources. The Mecklenburg County District Attorney, Spencer Merriweather, has said on this program many times that his office has not grown sufficiently to compensate for the increase in the population. He just got 10 extra district attorneys because of Arena's law, says he needs several dozen. 10 doesn't cut it. Sheriff Gary McFadden has consistently complained about a lack of resources in the jails. We've had conversations with judges who have similar complaints. You've been outspoken about the need for more resources in our legal system for a long time to handle the backlog of cases and reduce the time it takes for people to get to trial. How bad is it?
It's a problem. We've got three equal, I just talking about the branches of government.
Right.
We have three branches of government. In this state, we spend less than 3% of our budget in the state on the courts, which is supposed, you would think it'd be a third, right? It's less than 3%. But for the Mecklenburg County subsidizing the state, we would have less DAs. We would not have had our recovery courts. We continued drug courts that we have. We know them as recovery courts. We would have lost that. The county subsidizes in this county an incredible amount of resources that the state just doesn't cover.
How do you explain that politicians in general, Republicans in particular, like to run on law and order and get tough on crime, and yet they don't fund the courts? Why is that?
You have to ask them. We've been talking about it for a long time. That's not a question I can answer. What we've been trying to do is work smarter. Be as efficient as we can, but it's a problem when you don't have the resources.
You and other judges must speak. I'm assuming you would speak to the General Assembly, either collectively or individually. What have you heard back from them about this?
I mean, there are other needs, the typical things, right? You've got to, and they have other priorities. They hear us. They tell us they understand. They realize it's a problem. We have had some success in increasing salaries for court officials recently. So I think our Supreme Court has really done a lot to work with the General Assembly to try and get some more resources, but it's an ongoing problem.
The judicial branch of government.
And by the way, that problem existed when the Democrats were in control, when the Republicans were in control. It's just been an ongoing problem that the courts are underfunded.
The judicial branch should be, one would think, the least political branch of government, other two, the executive and the legislative branches. And yet, North Carolina judges are elected. And in the last several cycles, they have an R or a D after their names. Most people who go into the voting booth don't know anything about you guys. Nothing. They don't know how the court system works. They don't know what your cases have been, how you've decided. They don't know what the difference between a Republican judge or a judge who identifies as a Democrat is. Is this the way to do it? Should you be elected?
I think there are a lot of ways to do it. You can read between the lines. How about this? There are 21 district court judges there in Mecklenburg County. There are 8 superior court judges. I'm a judge, and I sometimes struggle with knowing everybody who's running when we have new candidates running for a position, and I'm a judge.
Right.
So if I'm struggling, imagine what, you know, my sister-in-law, who's got nothing to do with the court system, is thinking when she sees 29 races, and she doesn't know any of the people very well at all. It's a problem.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but when you came to the bench in 1999, judicial elections had become nonpartisan in order to reduce political influence. And that changed in 2017 with a law, and judicial elections became partisan again in 2018, the year you moved to Superior Court. Judges are supposed to rule on the law, not on politics. So why do we care? Why should you reveal whether you're running as a Republican or a Democrat?
I don't think you should. I like the nonpartisan system. I could make the argument that they make that people said even when it was nonpartisan, the Republicans would have a card that they handed out, right? And the Democrats would have a card that they handed out, and it would just happen to have the names of the nonpartisan officials that were Democrats or Republicans outside of court. But I think that a nonpartisan election system, if we're going to have an election system, is a much better way to do it.
But then again, everybody has biases. Everybody has.
That's right.
Everybody identifies with one philosophy or the other, whether you call it a political philosophy or not. So is this a more honest way to do it?
Well, it does tell you something about the candidate, right? You can at least have some snapshot idea of what the person stands for if you've got an R or D or an I and an independent by their name.
Because when you were in the circuit court, you were a Republican. But when you ran for Superior Court, you pulled the Trish Cotham. No, you didn't. You switched parties and became a Democrat, along with your mother, Minette Trosh, who many people remember was a member of Charlotte City Council for a while. When you made the switch, you said that you had not left the Republican Party. The party left you.
Yeah.
What's that mean?
I grew up in a family that was sort of traditional Republicans. I would say Reagan Republicans. I don't think that's where the party is anymore. That's about all I can say about it. I think that I felt like they moved to a place where I couldn't be a part of it any longer. That's just where same thing I said in 2000, I think it was 17, 16.
And that was the dawn of the MAGA Republican
That's right.
movement. They've completely taken over the Republican Party. Have things gotten worse, in your opinion?
I can't render an opinion about that. I can just say that things are...
But you're a judge.
Things
That's your
are
job.
Evolving. Yeah, I can preside in court, but I'm not going to give you a lot of political opinions about which side okay. I agree with or not.
The state Supreme Court recently went through an embarrassing battle between two candidates for the bench. One was the incumbent Democrat, and the other was a Republican and the Republican Party backing him did everything in their bag of tricks to get him into the job. Some believe that the Chief Justice, Paul Newby, a Republican, is more willing to display his partisanship. When you get to that level, what's at stake here? What does the infusion of politics into our courts mean for democracy and, more importantly, for our faith in justice?
I think it is a critical issue that's facing not only this community, but this state and this country. Judges have to be neutral. Judges have to be removed from politics.
Is our state Supreme Court neutral?
They are sworn to be neutral, yeah.
Are they?
I don't know. I can answer some questions, Mike. Some questions I just can't answer.
Because you don't know the answer, or because you can't?
In about a year, I can talk to you in a lot more detail about what I think about the politicization of our judiciary.
And what would happen if you answered now?
We have ethical responsibilities we have to follow, and so I can't. Hold my office.
Is the
or
state Supreme Court following those ethical responsibilities?
That's not in my purview to answer, Mike.
So just this year, you received the Julius L. Chambers Diversity Champion Award, which celebrates people in the community who have advanced the case of diversity and equal opportunity. And this comes at a time when diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts have been obliterated by the Trump administration, certainly, and even penalized in some cases by the Trump administration, and at a time when several members of the United States Supreme Court, including Clarence Thomas, seem to believe that we've reached parity and no longer require diversity or equity initiatives. What are your thoughts on that?
They should come to my courtroom and see what's going on in my courtroom in the cases.
You think they would care?
See.
Don't they see that at their level?
I can't answer for them. No, they don't see that. What they don't see, I see actual cases and the litigants that come in and the problems that they face. They see attorneys and larger legal issues, so they're not in the courtroom every day now.
When you look back on your time on the bench, and you've been there for a long time, what will you remember the most?
I have worked with an incredible group of people. I think that people that work in the court system are really unsung. It's a thankless job. I know that's a cliche, but I think that the people, and I'm not just talking about the lawyers and the judges, I'm talking about the bailiffs, I'm talking about the clerks, the case managers. They're dealing with incredibly hard issues with people that are hurting. That's who we see. We see people when they're hurting. And they're doing it with lack of resources. And they're doing it because they care, because we don't make a lot of money. I think everybody that works in the court system could go into the private sector and make more money in the private sector, but they're doing it because they care. And that has been and continues to be inspirational to me to work with so many people. And with those people, I feel like we made some really cool changes in the court system. All you have to do is go to the eighth floor of the courthouse. There's a mural that covers the entire floor, and it was created and painted by Charlotte Mecklenburg school students from, I think, 8 elementary schools, 4 junior high schools or middle schools, and several high schools. So they all played their part. And it is an incredible art piece. In fact, when we wanted to get that put on the 8th floor, the committee, the fancy art committee, was like, wow, are you going to put finger paints up? What are you doing? And we said, no, it's going to be really, really different. And I would stack that art up against the fancy whatever we paid for the art downstairs. And we did, that's a small thing. We did things like that throughout the system. That's what I'm most proud of.
If you could wave a magic wand and change one thing, what would it be? And I have 10 seconds.
All judges would have to wear the powdered wigs like they do in England.
And I would be a solicitor, not an attorney. Superior Court Judge Lou Trosh, thank you for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.